Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for coming out. It's good to see your lovely faces. We are The Blizzard. My name is Marcus from The Football Ramble. Let me introduce you to the panel on the end. Jonathan Wilson, the editor of The Blizzard, a contributor to many, many a wonderful publication. Obviously wrote Brian Clough's biography recently and Inverting the Pyramid. I'm sure you're all aware of his work. Next to him, David Conn, author of Bigger Than God, Manchester. Richer Than God. In my head, they're bigger as well, despite being God. A Christian. Yeah. Manchester City, Modern Football and Growing Up, and contributed to The Guardian. And Andy Brassel, BT Sports, Andy Brassel, contributed to The Guardian as well, ESPN, a lot of others. And the only man I've ever slept in the same bed with in Lisbon. Yeah, told you I'd get that in. It's not something I said that evening. Let us begin, gentlemen. Oh, before we do, let me tell you that I'm going to be asking the chaps a few questions myself. But do have your questions ready as well. Often at the start, people can be a little bit quiet, and then by the end of the evening, there's a forest of hands. So get straight in there. Again, not something I said that evening. Favourite transfer story while the window is just about still open. It's shutting very, very soon. But let's have a favourite transfer story from you, Jonathan.
I think, just in terms of sort of the Machiavellian way things worked, I think Romania in the 80s, it's very hard to beat. So, I mean, there's a few stories I could have gone for. I mean, for instance, Stefan Jovan, just before he moved to Steaua, Steaua the team of the army, Dinamo the team of the Securitate. Mm. And although they were both powerful in their own way, they were constantly squabbling with each other. And so Dinamo tried to halt his transfer by blackmailing him over this woman he'd left pregnant two years earlier. But I think my favourite one, just for the simplicity of it, there's a defender called Adrian Bumbescu who went on to play in the great Steaua side that won the European Cup in 86. And his move from Olt Conachesti was delayed for over a year because every time Steaua came to visit, they sent him to visit his family in Craiova. And eventually he said, hang on, I saw them like 2 weeks ago, what's going on? And they went, yeah, Steaua here. So, Adam Bumbescu to Steaua, yeah, I think 1983.
We're all very familiar with that one, no doubt. Don't worry, the answers will get easier. David, what about yourself? That's it, bring the mic in.
I mean, the favourite transfer story that I've ever worked on was a famously successful transfer signing by Sir Alex Ferguson of that great Portuguese prospect Bebe, which cost him only €9 million, and I think when they first presented it, I think there was talk of the new Ronaldo. I think there was talk of that, and then it took like a minute to look into it, and he'd played. He was homeless, wasn't he? And then he played He played in the Homeless World Cup. Then he played one season in the Portuguese third division, which when you actually saw pictures of where he was playing, it was like basically sort of like converted tennis courts type, that sort of level of, you know, sort of dusty clay pitches. And then one first division club thought, we'll give him a try. And he played two friendlies, I think, for this first division club. And United paid €9 million for him. His agent started complaining very loudly, and you could get to speak to his agent. Actually got, you know, really quite on quite good terms, quite friendly with his agent, who wanted the story told. And what had happened was that Jorge Mendes, the super agent in Portugal, had come in and said, I'll get you a move to Manchester United, but for some strange reason, Bebe sacked his agent and went with Jorge Mendes. And at the same time as Jorge Mendes became his agent, he also bought 30% of him, of the player, of his economic rights as well. So Manchester United, so he'd been his agent for about a week, and Manchester United paid €9 million, and Jorge Mendes got 40% of that, 30% of the economic rights, and 10% agent's fee, which meant he got €3.6 million from United for the sale of Bebe, who I think played in that FA Cup tie, didn't he, against Crawley Town, which was televised. And basically, all the Crawley Town players were better than Bebe. And Jorge Mendes made €3.6 million from that deal, and you have never had... And the answer from United was, it was our Portuguese scouts that spotted him, and we had to move fast.
His debut for United's reserves, just by chance, Richard Jolly wrote a piece of Blizzard on this, went to see him, and he said literally before kickoff they were showing him where to stand for corners. It was like Sylvester Stallone in his Ode to Victory. It was that bad.
But sorry for one last thing about Bebe, which you know, I still hope that one day we'll get the truth about Bebe and what that transfer, you know, what really happened over that transfer. But when they were comparing him to Ronaldo, like Cristiano Ronaldo was a football prodigy. Cristiano Ronaldo had been in Sporting Lisbon's academy since he was like one, and was known all around European football as, you know, a tremendously gifted and skillful player. Mm. Bebe had played two friendlies for a Portuguese first division club, had never been in an academy, had no reputation, and Manchester United paid €9 million for him and presented him as the new Ronaldo. That's the scouts for you. To be fair, he was bloody brilliant in those two friendlies for Game of Thrones. that's a different story.
What about you, Andy? Favourite transfer?
My one's like a more modern one from this season. I'm like everyone else. I just like a bit of straightforward chicanery. And I think the best one this summer was Abdelmadjid Waris, who was coming from Trabzonspor, to sign for Rennes. They'd been looking for a striker all summer, so they agreed the deal. They got him to fly over to Paris, where they sent a delegation to pick him up. They see him come off the plane, walk through arrivals. They say, "Welcome, Abdul," and he walks straight past them to a delegation from Lorient. He gets into their car, and they're stood there thinking, what happened there? Counter offer made while he was on the plane, and he didn't even say sorry.
My goodness.
Offer made on the plane?
Yeah. Well, while he was on the plane.
Yeah. Oh, right, yeah.
And they say you can't have your mobiles turned on. Well, chaps, what struck you about this particular transfer window? There's been an awful lot of money sloshing around. There's been some ridiculous transfer sagas all throughout the summer and so on and so forth. Jonathan, what struck you?
I think the most striking thing is the flexing of the muscle of the Premier League's middle class. That suddenly the likes of Swansea and Stoke have both the financial resources and the credibility to sign, you know, major players who wouldn't have given them a second thought. I mean, I think Andre Ayew going to Swansea is an extraordinary deal.
Is that another deal? Is that your agent?
It's not closed yet. Yeah.
Sorry, John.
I know Andre Ayew's second name is Morgan, which is weird.
Yeah.
But despite that, I'm pretty sure he didn't kind of grow up in France thinking, you know what, I really want to play for Swansea. And yet, you know, with presumably several other clubs in France and the rest of Europe interested in signing him, you know, he's 25 proven players, played well for Ghana for years. And yet he goes to Swansea. That I think shows the clout that the Premier League's middle class has. And that obviously is to do with the new TV deal. And then you sort of look at, well, where's the money going from this TV deal? And I think it's over £200 million now has gone from the Premier League into the Bundesliga this season. So, you know, this is a new dynamic, the extraordinary wealth of the Premier League and the way that sort of drifted down into Germany, really.
Mm. David?
Boringly, that's exactly what struck me as well. And I've just been writing about it. And it's what's also struck a lot of people in football as well. And I was in, I'm not saying this to name drop and be flash, but I was in Monaco last week at the Champions League draw working. And
it is a shithole, isn't it, Monaco?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it is not that great a gig. It really isn't. And it is a bit of a shithole. And also, you don't even buy a coffee there, because it's so expensive, because, you know, it's basically like a strip of not very attractive land that's basically, built to cater for people who don't want to pay their tax in their home countries and have got yachts moored in the marina, right? And it's so narrow, and it's steep, that if you walk up four flights of steps, you're over the border in France. And you can eat quite cheaply and have a nice time, and there's lots of normal people there, and that's where I had lunch and dinner, was in France. So anyway, there, that was a concern that people were raising from other countries, is the financial might of the Premier League now is basically imbalancing European football even more than it did before. And I think that because the new television deal was announced in February, and it's £5.136 billion, just for the domestic TV rights. And now all this money's being spent. People think that they're spending the new TV deal, but we're not in the new TV deal yet. That starts next season.
Well,
this is still the last year of the current TV deal, which is 5.5 billion altogether. And that money in itself, okay, there might be some money being spent in expectation of next year's TV deal, but basically the money they've got is the current TV deal. And as Jonathan said, the top clubs, there's five of Premier League clubs in the top 10 richest in the world, in Europe. And there's 14, I've just been looking at it.
Well, there's five between 21st and 30th in terms of revenue.
Yeah.
And so West Ham, the 21st richest club in the world. And then there's a new TV deal to come and moving to Olympic Stadium to come. Sunderland, for God's sake, are 27th richest. I mean, look at that squad. That really looks like the squad of a 27th richest.
When it comes to the big clubs, you've still got Real Madrid and Barcelona, who take the lion's share of the TV money in Spain. And you've got Paris Saint-Germain, obviously owned by Qatar. And you've got Bayern Munich, which still has massive commercial income. But apart from those four clubs, really, those four clubs do compete with Chelsea, United, and they still have, if you like, the best players, don't they? But that's why I agree with Jonathan that the real impact is on the middle ranking and even small clubs that can now sign players way out of their history. Like David Gold just tweeted, didn't he, about the widow has now closed.
Yeah.
The widow has now closed, David Gold said it's been the most amazing transfer window ever for West Ham, which it has been.
Well, apart from when they signed Tevez and Mascherano.
That's very true. Yeah.
Well, that's another story for later.
But what about yourself, Andy? What struck you? You were talking about a lot of money going into the Bundesliga.
Yeah, well, and the same with the middle-class clubs in France as well. It's been a great window for them in a totally reverse way to what it has for English clubs. And, you know, I think they're further down the line. I think the Bundesliga clubs are still a little bit in denial. They're, oh, no, what does this mean for our future if all the talent goes away? But I think the French clubs are a little bit further away. You had the co-president of Saint-Etienne, Roland Romier, saying earlier in the season, like, English clubs are going to be playing a different sport from us in a year's time. But you know what? I think now they've got to that point where they've set ridiculous fees, like, you know, say when there was English interest in Jordan Veretout, and their president, Valdemar Keita, said, well, I'll tell you what, if you want him, you're going to have to pay 15 million euros, thinking that's a prohibitively high price. And Villa turn around and say, yeah, okay.
only 15 yeah. million euros.
And, you know, there was, I think the thing that describes it best, how the French are feeling about it in the moment in terms of filling their boots, and of course that brings us onto the whole Martial deal that has come out over the last day or so, is on the opening day of the second division in France, which was the week before Ligue 1 started, there was a little vine of a guy scoring from the halfway line, and a French journalist tweeted it and said, for God's sake, don't retweet this, because the English will pay 20 million for him on Monday. and that says it all. They're just filling their boots. And you know what? I think the idea that English clubs are going to exist in this financial bubble forever is just nonsense. Because ultimately, all this money is going to drip through to clubs who are going to be able to completely rebuild. If you look at what Sevilla did on the back of, we're going back a couple of years before we even get into this big deal, and, you know, whether it's coming or not, it's kind of like the new NBA TV deal, which starts in another year. Clubs are already, franchises are already starting to spend, because they're thinking, well, if we speculate a bit now, it may look like pushing the boat out, but it might look like it's cheap in a year's time when the money really has kicked in. And I just think they're sort of having a bit of a look now. They're putting it out there, and they're thinking, you know, this is going to save us money. But in fact, you look at the clubs that are able to rebuild with that money. If we go back a couple of years to Sevilla, you know, they've made bad financial choices. They're in hock to a lot of third-party owners who had their hooks in a lot of their players. But then they sold Alvaro Negredo here for far more than they thought was possible. They had an asking price of about 20 million, and they ended up selling him for more than that. They sold Jesus Navas, And Monchi, their very good sporting director, managed to build a new team through that. Mm. Since then, they've won the Europa League twice. They've got back into the Champions League and stuff like that. And, you know, you look at the drip down, like with the Martial deal, for example. Now, Lyon, who are a Champions League, back in the Champions League, and, you know, if you look at where they're at the moment and where United are at the moment, you know, they could be rivals in this season's Champions League. There's no doubt about it. They're going to get not up to 19 million euros for a player that they sold 2 years ago.
Sure.
And how does that not have an effect on the bigger picture?
Well, Jonathan, you were saying on the way up here that clubs, they're already spending the money on these deals, as Andy talked about.
And I mean, perhaps, I think some are beginning to speculate with next year's money. Yeah.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. Some clubs are thinking, hang on a minute, let's make sure the money is in one's account before you start spending, we all do before the end of the month.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's certainly the Shorts' policy, is that he's a little bit concerned about, you know, is the future really as rosy as it appears? And I do slightly worry. I mean, I'm not sure this is a short-term concern, but maybe in 3 or 4 years, there's this sort of assumption that football is immune from global economic trends. And so far, English football certainly has been. You know, the crash of 2007-08 doesn't really seem to have affected English football. But you know, is that always going to be the case? And I'm not sure you can be quite that confident. And if you look at what's happened in China in the last fortnight, with 20% being wiped off share prices there, which caused the 10% fall in European stock markets, which we had a bounce back. But the recovery after 2007-08 was predicated on growth in China, an economy that was growing incredibly quickly, I mean, over 10% a year. Well, if that's slowed down, if that's actually stopped, if it's even going backwards, and the figures aren't entirely reliable, but it's clearly not as rosy a picture as it was 6-7 years ago. If we have another crash, where does the growth come from? It's not coming from China. And does that then impinge on football as well as everything else? And you've got to think,
isn't it great what's happened to football? You know, like we've been here 5 minutes.
Yeah,
talking about how the Chinese stock market crashed and affect English football.
Having
said that, there's in terms of TV revenues, which are obviously a very major part of revenues for football clubs, the prognosis for that looks incredibly healthy, because you've got Sky and BT who are chucking huge amounts of money at it. I mean, Sky spending so much to head off the challenge of BT that they lose the Champions League, they nearly lose La Liga, that they've lost some cricket. And, this Discovery have now bought Eurosport, and presumably that's with an eye to buying European football rights. So that suggests that the competition for those rights is going to get even more intense in the next 5-10 years. So from that point of view, it looks incredibly good, incredibly good if you see money as good. But I think China should be.
Just make one point about that, which I think is really important now that the television money is such big part of football's football's survival, football's means, and such a big part of our conversation, and it's governing all these player moves and so on. It's the base of the economy. It is a consumer business, though. The money is not coming from Sky and from BT. It is coming from the subscribers. Sky and BT are only paying that money because they can still make a massive profit. Okay, BT might even treat it as a bit of a loss leader, but I presume that they've still got a model where they're going to make a big profit, because they're buying football up exclusively. And football has always been, right from the beginning of the Premier League in 1992, the one piece of programming that people are so addicted to and in love with that they're prepared to pay a subscription for it. And so Barney Ronay of The Guardian wrote a really good piece at the weekend where he said, when they strike a TV deal, why is there always backslapping between men in suits and everybody congratulating themselves? Whereas basically what it means is, we're going to keep all the football live exclusively on pay TV. There's never been, that Sky advert at the moment, 23 years together, there's never been one single live league, Premier League game on the BBC or ITV for 23 years. And the more money that they pay to the clubs, the more the subscriptions have always gone up. So it is a consumer business, which is why I think that as long as people are basically in work here and addicted to football, they know that they've got a license to print money, and that's why I think it's immune to economic shocks.
Absolutely. Let's open it to the floor. We will be talking about other stuff than just the financial side of the game. Don't be too put off. Any questions immediately? Nobody at the moment. Oh, yes, sir. One over there. We're going to have microphones coming over so we can all hear your manly tones. I'm basing that on your beard. Yes, sir. Far
I'd
away.
I'd like to be the first question. Oh, hi.
Yeah,
while you're talking about the Football League deals in England, I was just curious as to whether you thought that might cause like a redistribution of wealth in Spain and Germany and places like that, and whether the fact that all the money goes to the big clubs there has any impact on their negotiation and their ability to drive up bigger deals, and whether that will always leave them behind Britain.
So football deals in this country will affect other countries?
No, sorry. So in England, I've negotiated a huge... TV deal.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious about whether in Germany and Spain, a lot of the money seems to be held within the big clubs there, and whether the fact that it's not distributed means that they're in a weaker bargaining position, and whether we see any change to that.
Okay.
Well, it's interesting because the sort of egalitarian model they've got in Germany has always been a spectre threatening the future of German football, really, because you have one club there who is much bigger than all the rest. And, of course, Dortmund can challenge for a couple of years. Hamburg can challenge for a couple of years, although not at the moment. But Bayern will always be there. Bayern will always come back to the top, come what may. And for years, like, Bayern have used this as blackmail, really, on the rest of German football, to say, look, if we don't get what we want, maybe we'll have to go off and form a European Super League. Now, of course, they've got no takers for that in England at the moment, because everyone's very well served in keeping the status quo. In terms of Spain, everything's really changing at the moment. That was something that held up the English TV deal here as well, because the deal of La Liga with England, of course, because you had four clubs, including Barcelona and Real Sociedad, who wouldn't subscribe to the collective bargaining model that was brought in by Spanish law. So it's really interesting to see how that's going to change, because Javier Tebas, who's the president of the league, he's not a reformer at all. He thinks that big Barcelona and big Real Madrid is good for the brand internationally, and it should stay like that. And as we saw with the back and forth over the rights between Sky and BT, because of course BT thought they had it and didn't, the people who sell the international rights on behalf of La Liga are A, incompetent, and B, sharks. So how that's going to pan out, who knows, over the next couple of years.
What is actually happening with the Spanish deal then?
So into the mic, David.
Have they brought in a law that they do have to have a collective deal?
And yeah, they have.
And Real Madrid aren't going to take the lion's share.
Well, they have to have a collective deal, but there's still room for staging
and
sort of balance depending on... who's that big inside it. And of course, Real Madrid were in favour of that, because I think they know that, as a league product, it's really difficult to sell something internationally where you've only got two teams in the league. I mean, it's been called posh Scotland on however many occasions. And I think, there's a lot of people feel that. But Barcelona have not been in favour of that at all. I suppose it comes down to the, really, I suppose, Catalonia's economic history, really. They've always felt they were better off on their own, and that counts TV rights too.
David, something I wanted to ask yourself about was a little bit of FFP chat. We don't have to spend too long on it, don't worry.
Not in Manchester.
obviously in your book you talk about the riches of Manchester City and all, and clubs seem to be spending so much money. We heard about this FFP business coming in. QPR seemed to get away with an £8 million fine when people thought it was going to be in the 50s and 60s of millions. What's going on with it, quite frankly? Have they kind of pulled back on what they originally set out to do with FFP, or are they maybe dripping it in, so to speak?
No, they haven't. They haven't changed it at all. And I just think there's a perception that it was meant to do things that it actually wasn't. And it's actually had a really major impact in the way that UEFA wanted it to have. Obviously, QPR, the FFP issue with QPR is the Football League. And topically, I was talking to the Football League on the way over, hands free, and they said that they're still. I think there might even be court proceedings with QPR. Mm. So the reports that QPR have got away with it, and I don't think are quite right. Also, Leicester, there's quite an interesting FFP issue there, because Leicester, when they're in the Championship, it looked like they made a massive loss, and the Football League's losses were limited to about, I think it was 8 million, and above that, you could get fines that steepled up really sharply. And then Leicester announced
that they'd done a deal for global sponsorship, for global marketing of Leicester City, with a company called Tree Stella. And Tree Stella had paid such a lot of money that it practically put them, you know, into breaking even, and they wouldn't have any fine to pay. And Tree Stella turned out to be registered on a Sheffield trading estate to a company owned by the son of the former Premier League chairman, Sir Dave Richards, neither of whom have got any track record in international marketing of any clubs whatsoever. Dave Richards Jr. runs this tiny printing company on this trading estate in Sheffield, and Leicester City have said, they've paid us multi-millions of pounds for the exclusive rights to market us worldwide. And David Richards Jr. wasn't prepared to discuss it with me in any detail. Dave Richards Sr. had a company called Three Star Engineering, which went bust in 2001, and then he became the first ever paid Premier League chairman on £176,000 for 3 days' work, annual salary for 3 days' work. And Tree Stella seems like a remarkably close a construction of words as three star, which obviously Sir Dave Richards has a sentimental attachment to the name. Anyway, anyway, in terms of FFP, just so I don't hog the microphone, FFP was brought in not to create equal competition. It wasn't brought in as a conspiracy by Michel Platini against Manchester City, regardless of what it says in Manchester City fanzines, and regardless of sort of like the propaganda which has taken hold in some parts, not too far from here. It was brought in to stop too many clubs making losses in the greatest financial boom that football's ever had. And the main thing that they were trying to do was stop players' wages inflating. Every time there's a TV deal increase, the players basically got it. And it has actually had some great success. Losses have reduced across European football. And then the Premier League, which ranted against it and said it was, you know, Michel Platini's like a man in the pub sort of thing, ended up bringing in their own version of FFP, which last year instantly transformed the clubs from mostly making losses to mostly making profits. And they're now sitting on big cash reserves. Ellis Short was one of the big supporters of it, I think, because now the television deal increased.
Though he's still paying the eighth highest wage in the Premier League.
Yeah, but the television deal increased, but they can't. They limited how much of that increase can go on players' wages. So in those terms, it's actually been a success. And the wages, the fees paid in this transfer window haven't really been blowing out FFP. Like, even City, who seem to spend a huge amount of money, have spent a huge amount of money. UEFA, in Monaco, people I was talking to were saying they're confident that City are within break even or within the limits because they're making so much money now where they are in football, and it is opening up the next challenge, which is clearly it does create or it does nothing to help competition, because basically football is very, very competitively imbalanced. Now for me, allowing clubs to be taken over by Abu Dhabi, Qatar and Russian oligarchs is not a sensible way to create competition in football or a sustainable way. But it kind of looks like that to people because they say, well, at least City have managed to get up there, at least Paris Saint-Germain have got, at least Chelsea have. So taking that away has made people think, well, suddenly we've got no way of evening competition, even though for me that wasn't a way of evening competition. But I think it's such a hard challenge because basically the only way to even competition is to make clubs share money more equally. And as you were saying, in Spain, the clubs very rarely want to do that because they're always looking at their own interest. They're always looking at the one who's richer than them, not at everybody else who's
about
the same.
And of course,
as them.
The richer the big clubs get, they kind of threaten the smaller clubs. I mean, when you originally had this chat in Spain about them creating collective bargaining, no one would go for it. You had Sevilla and Valencia trying to lead some sort of breakaway group to have collective bargaining. And all the rest of them thought, well, what are we going to do if Real Madrid and Barcelona hop it? And, you know, Real and Barca always use that hold over the smaller clubs to basically make them into turkeys voting for Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely. Now we've got some questions. Yes, a man with a fine leather jacket. Feel free to change the subject, by the way. We don't have to talk about
that. Yeah, this might move on to a slightly different topic, but it does start here. We all know that when you've got stakeholders in football, whether it's the clubs or associations or people, if they're well looked after, then change is more difficult. Is the huge financial success of the Premier League the one or the major thing that they've got in their favour, which will stop any kind of FA reform and therefore stop any, let's say, big improvement in player numbers in the Premiership from England and therefore the England team. So will their financial success stop FA reform?
Jonathan, any particular thoughts?
In a word.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's the FA is essentially powerless. And, you know, the FA did a deal with the Premier League. Well, when the Premier League began, the FA basically, it saw its most important, the most important thing to it, the most important issue, was its ongoing battle with the Football League for control of English football. It recognised a way of getting control away from Football League, but in doing that, they've completely neutered themselves. You know, the FA basically is if the Premier League clubs decide to do something, what's the FA going to do? You know, the Premier League clubs have it fantastically good at the minute in terms of making money. They know they've got a great product. Everybody wants to buy it. Everyone wants to watch it. What's the FA going to do? The only way you could do something about that would be to have government legislation. As soon as you do that, FIFA get involved and say you can't have government legislation. And that's, you know, it's a very clear FIFA regulation. So, yes, is the answer.
Is the answer. Good. Any more questions? Yes, man there, have we got the microphone? It's just come in, sir. And fire away.
Hello. So what, looking at the kind of, going back to the issue of the TV deal issue,
when I compare
kind of the size of markets, like in different groups, I'm looking at like reasons why we went to the pay TV market system that the UK did compared to, say, the NFL, that's still on national television, on like advert-driven. I mean, the nature of the business, nature of the sport affects that. Mm. But at the same time, do you think it's just the scale of like the smaller levels of the markets that make it impossible to have like a kind of preview, free-to-air version of the game?
I think the Premier League would never have been set up without Sky, so yeah, those two things just went together.
No, they could have done a deal with ITV. Were going to do a deal with them, weren't they?
But I mean, right from the start.
No, ITV were going to do the first deal, and Greg Dyke was at ITV, and he agreed to back the breakaway and do a deal with them. But so an ITV would have been advertising driven, and it all could have been.
The point is, it wasn't.
Because Sky gazumped them with the price that they paid.
Yeah, so right from the start, the two were together.
Yeah.
So and once that's happened, and once Sky have seen how powerful the Premier League is, they're never going to. I mean, that's why they've increased, 70% increase on this TV deal. So, yeah, I mean, I think the two are just. Yeah.
And of course, without that deal, we wouldn't perhaps know the television careers of Keys and Gray, so be thankful.
He had a go at Richard Keys last year.
Has the man changed?
And that was just because he said Doha was a lovely place to be, wasn't it?
Yeah, indeed he did. And a lot more other things. Any more questions? Yes, that man right there.
Who should replace Sepp Blatter?
Who should replace Sepp? Oh, Keys and Gray. they're already there. Andy, who should replace Keys and Gray? And I don't know who. Take your pick.
You're not obsessed, are you?
Who should replace Blatter?
Well, you know what? For the moment, I don't really think that's the issue. I don't think it makes any difference. The idea that he's the mastermind behind it all.
Well, yeah, not necessarily. The question is who.
No. But it's. I think it's a relevant point. The idea that. Changing the president is really going to change the way FIFA runs. I don't think it's correct.
But that might not be the motive behind the question, though.
No, it might not be.
Yeah.
But I think it's an angle worth covering.
Jeremy Corbyn, I don't know. Jonathan, who would you fancy?
I think people in North America, in Western Europe, struggle to understand why Blatter remained so popular for so long. And I think the reason is essentially what came not just before Blatter but before Havelange. So there's still, if you talk to people in African federations, in Asian federations, Central American federations, and they all go, oh, we don't want to go back to the days of Stanley Rouse. Now, Rouse was not corrupt, but that's by the end, that was pretty much the only good thing you could say about him. I mean, he was a man who insisted that the Soviet Union had to play a World Cup qualifying playoff in the Estadio Nacional in Santiago, which had been used a matter of days beforehand as a torture and detention centre after the Pinochet coup, against a democratically elected Marxist government. So you can see why, I mean, anybody would have problems with that, but the Soviets in particular. Rouse's attitude to Africa and Asia was, I think, through modern eyes, it looks racist. And I think there's a huge fear outside of Europe that FIFA would go back to being essentially a European organisation, and that all the development that's happened in African and Asian football over the last 40 years would be halted. Now, I think what that view misses is the fact that things could have been done even better for Africa and Asia, but Blatter did take the World Cup to South Africa, which remains an astonishing achievement, and symbolically is a key moment in the development of the African game. So I think, I know Blatter is Swiss, but he was always sort of perceived as being anti-European or anti-UEFA. And so for the new president to be somebody from UEFA, I think is potentially dangerous. I think it's very difficult for it to be somebody from UEFA because the African Confederation, CAF, has 54 votes. They vote as a bloc. They're the strongest bloc that in terms of nobody ever splinters away from that. Hayatou, the Cameroonian president of CAF, has great power there. So I think realistically, if there is to be meaningful reform, if people are really going to reassess what is FIFA about, how do we make it transparent, how do we make it work for everybody, the ideal is a non-European. Now, are there realistic candidates? I really struggle to see them. Maybe the best candidate would be somebody from outside football, somebody beyond reproach, somebody with impeccable integrity. So, and Kofi Annan was mooted ages ago, and I don't think that's serious, but that kind of person would probably be the ideal. Otherwise, somebody with great integrity, somebody beyond reproach within football, I'm thinking Sven-Göran Eriksson.
Now you're talking. Now you're talking. Football will get a lot sexier, certainly. David, who would you quite like to see?
I sort of agree with both Andy and Jonathan in the sense that I don't actually think that focusing on Blatter has been one of the problems. I think that it's got to be a better organisation, and one of the reasons why it's been such an awful organisation is because the figure of president has been so almost like autonomous, so powerful. And in fact, absolutely right what Jonathan says about Sir Stanley Rouse, who's like the quintessential English blazer, who was a man completely out of time. There's profiles of him sitting, this is like in 1970 when, Brazil were winning the World Cup with the team with Pelé and Jairzinho and Gerson, that sort of carnival of football in colour from Mexico. And Sir Stanley Rouse was working in the office in Zurich, wearing a cardigan with his Labrador at his feet in the office, and there was a staff.
That actually sounds quite nice.
It's really nice, but you think, how is he running a world organisation? He was like the quintessential English blazer, for all the good things that entails. He'd been an international referee, he'd been secretary of the Football Association for years. He was a pioneer of football administration in a lot of ways. He rewrote the rules of football in 1938, but he was a man out of time. And he was replaced by the Brazilian João Havelange. And Havelange was, in a way, more than Blatter, involved in that expansion, and that was a platform he stood on, the expansion of football beyond Europe and the base that Europe had always had and the domination it had always had. Expanded the number of countries that could play in the World Cup and welcomed in, he's from Brazil, and broadened the game and recognised that the game had gone way beyond its European boundaries. At the same time, him and his son-in-law helped themselves to £27 million in bribes from ISL when they granted the TV rights to them. And they set that culture, which Blatter was his protege, and Blatter worked up in FIFA under Havelange.
He was secretary, wasn't he?
He was the Secretary General of FIFA under João Havelange. And he learnt the ropes under Havelange. He joined Havelange. He wasn't there under the Sir Stanley Rouse culture. And so he learned the culture under Havelange, which is expand the game, expand it beyond Europe, sell the TV rights and the commercial rights for as much as you can, and
have a bloody good time.
Turn a blind eye to what they all get up to, as long as they support you. And when you actually put together the scale of corruption that has been proven and uncovered, that is no longer allegations amongst FIFA, like just one of them, just even like a tenth of one of them, should be enough to sink an organisation, to make the leader resign, and for complete reform. But we've had, I mean, it's utterly staggering. What Jack Warner, I was reading one, that internal CONCACAF report, which said, and this is like quite lesser known in this country because there's been so much. And Jack Warner's the Trinidadian former president of CONCACAF, which is Caribbean, North Africa, North and Central America, who was one of the people who was hounded by the English journalist Andrew Jennings when he was, you know, exposing some of the early corruption at FIFA. And it's that lovely clip for Panorama or someone where he's chasing him through the airport and Jack Warner says, "I would not spit on you." So Andrew Jennings says, Andrew Jennings loves the doorstep on camera. He absolutely thrives on it. Like, they're always talking about Andrew Jennings like, oh, like, When the England World Cup bid was trying to stop the BBC exposing corruption because, as they wrote to all the FIFA Executive Committee, as members of the football family, we feel solidarity with you. We disown the BBC's efforts. And they were always saying to us, oh, we're in Zurich and Andrew Jennings was jumping out of hedges again. But anyway, so
the first time I ever met Jennings was in Bamako in 2002. So just before the Cup of Nations,
and there
was
no hedges for him to jump.
No, but there were stone pillars. So the CAF Congress is going on, and I'm sort of I'd never covered a Cup of Nations before. I didn't really know what was going on. I was sort of wandering around and see this sort of this man who looks a bit like John Pertwee hiding behind a pillar. So he looks pretty English to me. I'll go and speak to him. And I went over and sort of introduced myself. And he, shh, he pulls me down. And then, you know, literally within 30 seconds, he's jumping out. Did you take a bribe? Have you taken a bribe?
Yeah.
And I thought, God, is that actually what journalism is? It's kind of yeah. Turns out it is for him, but not really anybody else.
That's it, because, you know, with journalism, you know, you get a lot of your information and stories by actually being nice to people, talking to them, gaining their confidence. But Andrew Jennings, you know, did tend to jump out behind edges with the microphone anyway. So he was chasing Jack Warner through this airport, and Jack Warner said, "I would not spit on you." I would not spit on you. So Andrew Jennings said, "Oh really? Oh really? Why? Why, Mr. Warner? Why would you not spit on me?" He said, "I would not dignify you with my spit." So that's Jack Warner, which I think is like the quintessential Jack Warner, you know, archetypal.
I loved what Jennings said about Jack Warner when they asked him about it, and he went, He's uncultured, isn't he? I thought that was absolutely wonderful. We're going to have to wrap up the first half, though.
Can I just finish?
Okay.
Just finish on the scale of corruption at FIFA. So just while we're on it. So besides Jack Warner being someone who would say to somebody, "I would not dignify you with my spit," he had pretty much a similar attitude to the money in FIFA. And just two bits, which I'll try and run through really quickly. So you know, like the massive 161-page indictment from the US authorities that is, you know, is charging 14 people, including 9 FIFA officials, with that massive... It says you are a racketeering, influenced, corrupt organisation, which is basically what they call the mafia. And that's what Sepp Blatter's most offended by. You know, did you hear what they called us? That's, you know, he's more offended by them calling him that than about the corruption that the people that he worked with for all those years have been accused of. Anyway, within that is the one where Jack Warner is accused of taking $10 million as a bribe from South Africa to vote for South Africa for the 2010 World Cup, which sort of slightly undermines the wonder of it being held in Africa for the first time, doesn't it?
Well, it's extraordinary they needed a bribe, given that there was pretty much no other viable candidate. I know Morocco kind of got just about within touching distance, but that was it was always going to be in South Africa. So,
yeah,
if people were taking $10 million bribes for something that was a fait accompli, then
So basically, South Africa have denied that it was a bribe, and they've said that. And so have FIFA. And they've said it was $10 million for the Africa Diaspora Legacy Programme that happened to be run by Jack Warner, who was paid a very round figure of $10 million. That's exactly how much the Legacy Programme has got, $10 million.
And I think we can all agree it's done great work since, hasn't it?
Money well spent.
And also for the Africa Legacy Programme, it would just be where Jack Warner is, isn't it? That's the, you know, that's where the African diaspora is basically in Jack Warner's backyard, right? And so they've said you can't prove it. And if you look at, there's a FIFA report which actually says $10 million accounted for, paid for the African Legacy Diaspora Programme. But where Jack Warner's slightly, you know, in trouble is that Chuck Blazer, his mate, who worked for him all those years, has told the American authorities, Jack Warner told me it was a bribe from South Africa. So that's the $10 million, and we're waiting to see whether he gets extradited and what happens to him. Mm. And then I was reading, there was an internal CONCACAF report into the running of CONCACAF by Jack Warner and Chuck Blazer. Okay. And it found that Jack Warner had defrauded CONCACAF and FIFA, because when FIFA were giving them money to build a centre of excellence in Trinidad, Jack Warner was continually telling them that this was a wonderful asset, that was going to be a wonderful asset for CONCACAF, and never told them once that he owned the land. Right. So Jack Warner was getting them to pay money to him instead of to CONCACAF. And the amount of money that he was accused of defrauding FIFA by that was paid to the Centre of Excellence was $26 million.
That's not just, even half of Anthony Martial.
Yeah, that's just that's just one of his little schemes, just one of them.
It's so. Almost applaudable. It's that bad. We're going to finish the first half there. We're going to take a 10-minute break, but as you can see, you know, we're not just going to talk about finances and FIFA and all the rest of it. We can do if that's what you want to ask, but get
let's do jokes. Come on,
all that kind of stuff. The chaps have got ridiculous stories from football. Jonathan in the African Cup of Nations. Goodness knows what he got up to there, etc. And so on. Nothing terrible. Don't worry. So we'll see you in about 10 minutes. Thank you very much. Right then, everybody, this is the second half, just like we promised. And we're going to begin by asking about favourite football diva moments. This is in light of Jermaine Defoe, obviously advertising for a PA, which is quite wonderful, really. In a world of player liaisons, we've heard many stories involving them and having to change light bulbs, that kind of thing. Players often live in a bubble behind the velvet curtain of the velvet rope of the Premier League. So, gentlemen, favourite kind of football diva moments, if you like, Jonathan.
You're talking about Jermaine Defoe. Kind of, I don't quite understand how his PA is getting paid $5,000 a year less than John Joe Shelby's chef. Mm. See, it seems to me that the chef gets the better deal there.
Yeah.
What was it like, had to liaise with Gardner? Was that one of the duties? Yeah. You had to liaise with the Gardner?
Again, we refer to Barney Ronay, but the idea is he's had to put two stages between himself and nature. but it's, I mean, I guess it's not really a diva thing, but in terms of football liaison officers, there's...
Or a ridiculous sort of story with the football.
Yeah, no, it's there's a football liaison officer who... worked at Blackburn for a long time, who was sort of quite well known. He was very sort of vocal with journalists. And he was very close, surprisingly, given the backgrounds of the two people. But he became very close to Michel Salgado. And quite regularly, Michel Salgado would be in the pub and he'd have nobody to play pool against. So he'd ring him up and say, Matt, can you come down and give us a game of pool? So... Yeah, a football liaison officer whose job was to keep Michel Salgado entertained by playing pool against him.
That is brilliant. A far cry from Madrid, no doubt, for Michel. What about you, David?
I must admit that not only do I not really spend that much time with footballers in their diva moments, but I've also always been a bit of a defender of footballers and think that they get a bad press, and that generally the ones that I've met have been actually pretty intelligent, decent, nice people who've worked hard. They're just the ones I've met. But in terms of like how much money they've got and the costed world they live in, just a little, perhaps a bit of an insight for you with a bit of local geography. So when I was writing a piece about City once, which actually, you know, I've had quite a lot of access to City under the Abu Dhabi regime, and they were wanting to show me just how they'd modernised everything and all the money has been spent wisely and they were showing me that the new player welfare department, because they were saying that previously players just used to arrive and no one gave a toss, basically, and you know they could just go wherever and they can't find a doctor, they can't find a house, obviously. And they said, you know, we help them look for a house, and you'll see that we've got a whole department dedicated to finding a house. Now, I grew up in Manchester. I was born in Salford. I grew up in North Manchester, Prestwich, and was quite interested in like the local advice that they were giving to the players about where to live. So I went to the player welfare estate agency style service that Manchester City put on. And North Manchester does not exist to the footballers of Manchester. And the only areas on this list were Alderley Edge,
Hale, Wilmslow, and for urban, I think it said, it honestly said, for the edgy urban experience, Didsbury.
Very good. Dandy.
Wow. Mm. Well, it's interesting hearing both the lads talk about player liaison officers and how much that's come on, really. I mean, I remember just a couple of years ago, not all clubs are down with that already, just a couple of years ago, I was on a holiday with my family in southern Spain during the January transfer window, and Sevilla had just signed a Senegalese striker called Baba. I went to his presentation in the afternoon, seeing as I was there. Asked a couple of questions. You know, it's very hard to completely park work for a couple of weeks.
Just like Harry Redknapp, always working.
that's right. And anyway, we went to there's a really nice tapas restaurant just opposite the Novion where Sevilla play. And we sat down and we noticed on the table next to us was a guy, and my wife pointed him out and said, he doesn't seem to know what he's doing, really. And he was just stuck with the menu, not really knowing what was going on. It was Baba. He was signed for $3 million in the afternoon, and then the club obviously pushed him out, left him to it. Mm. He was struggling to fit a SIM card into his phone to obviously ring home. And so I said, are you all right there? Do you need a bit of help? And I ended up ordering for him and fixing his phone.
Oh, hey.
But not at his behest. He didn't demand it.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're talking about diva behaviour,
yeah.
I think we'll go back
because
to
that. Because that was quite a nice story of you helping a fellow man out there.
Well, it didn't do him any good. I mean, he never got in the first team. But
okay, but did he,
at least
but
he could ring home and say, I'm not in the first team. I hate it here. So that was okay. But I think I'd go back to being with Portugal during the 2014 World Cup. You think you know where this is going, don't you? You really think you know where this is going. But I was with the Portugal team who arrived in Manaus in the Amazon for the second game against the USA. They arrived quite late after the four-hour flight from near Sao Paulo. As the team were checking in, there was quite a flustering reception because an unnamed member of the Portuguese playing staff had demanded 12 white roses to be left in his room, which is bloody hard to find in Manaus at half past, it turns out. So anyway, junior member of hotel staff goes out, finds 12 white roses while we're all sat there in the bar. Wow. She comes in at about 1:45. She's very proud of herself, lifting them like the Champions League trophy, and drops them on the floor. No. And it was just like in the school canteen when someone drops their tray and everyone just put their drink down, turned around and went, well, this poor girl was getting the broom out, and presumably Raul Morelos was one very, very disappointed.
All right. Okay. Well, it wasn't the one I was thinking, but fair enough.
Maybe it wasn't really Raul Morelos.
Oh, okay. We'll call him, I don't know, Christian Ronald or something like that. Have we got any questions from Twitter, Gareth? Is the mic on? That man will turn
right, on. Right, are we working now? That's better.
There we go.
So this is from Sean A on Twitter.
There is a bloke sat there, by the way. You're not going.
So from Sean A on Twitter, he simply says, as a Man United fan, WTF.
Yeah.
So take that however you like.
As a Manchester United fan, what the fuck? That is what that means.
That.
Yeah, okay. Just in case. Jonathan, what is going on at Manchester United?
I have no idea. When Van Gaal arrived, I had this... Well, there's a story told of... let's name him. Rob Draper from the Mail on Sunday. Mm. This is before Van Gaal got to United. He was at some dinner and Van Gaal was there. So this is before... Yeah, Van Gaal, I guess, was... Maybe he's after Bayern, but you know he hadn't been. I don't know if he was Dutch national manager at the time. Anyway, so Van Gaal is at this dinner, and Rob Draper, idolised the Ajax team of the 90s as many people of our generation did. He sees Van Gaal, gets very excited, and Rob Draper's with his wife, and goes rushing over to him between courses, and says to his wife, "Yeah, this is Louis Van Gaal. This is the man. This is the man who invented modern football." And then he thinks, oh, God, I've gone too far there. Like, that's just it's really embarrassing. And now Louis van Gaal's sitting going, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I kind of agreed with him. I thought Van Gaal... I still have this sort of faith that Van Gaal will somehow pull it around. And
journalistically, he's brilliant. I mean, every press conference, it's like the entire world seen through Downfall parodies. After the Newcastle game, when Rooney had that goal, it was very tight offside goal given against him, and Van Gaal disagrees with this, and he's claiming the television shows clearly that it was onside, which it didn't. But and he sort of ends his sort of discussion this by going, and this ish what you must have. I was listening. Is that just sort of silence? Was
is that the reason 10. Why we should have eyes?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he said eyes.
No, eyes.
Oh, okay, right.
If God gave us eyes, so we could see that Wayne Rooney was possibly onside.
Yeah.
I have to say, I'm increasingly bewildered by what's going on. I've written two pieces about it for The Guardian recently about his obsession with process, which I guess there's two ways of setting up a team. You either get the process right or you get the individuals right. There's the starting point. Ideally, the two come together. But you can sort of say, right, we'll have 10 chances, they'll have 10 chances, but our centre forward's better than theirs, so we'll probably win the game. That's one way of doing it. Or you can say, we'll set up a way of playing so that we're pretty certain we'll have 12 chances and they'll have no more than 4. And so that weight of numbers of chances should enable us to win the game. And he seems obsessed by keeping possession, by denying the opposition chances. So it's a very sort of, it's a cautious proactivity. Yes, they have the ball, which is a proactive approach, but they have it in a way that is risk-free. And there's a very interesting line from Siak Spark when he's talking about the Ajax of the mid-90s, the team that won the Champions League, that great team with... Mm. I mean, he's talking about the two wingers, about Marco Overmars and Fanidi George. Siak Spark had been a winger in Michael's team in the early 70s. And Spark got really frustrated with Overmars and Fanidi George, because every time they had two men between them and the goal, they would check back, play the ball in field, work it to the other wing, see if there's an opportunity to attack there. They'd never take on the first man, because if you've got two men between you and the goal, you take on the first man, maybe the ball rolls away from you a bit, the second man takes it off you. And I think you can see exactly that with United at the minute, that when they're playing against teams who aren't Club Brugge, teams who are actually good at defending, they keep on finding more than one man between them and the goal. And so they check back, and Yanisai, you could see it repeatedly. I think that Newcastle game was really obvious. He'd get the ball, he'd have 10 or 15 yards in front of him, he'd start to accelerate, and you could almost see the thought hit him, I can't beat this first man because somebody behind him might lose it, and then Van Gaal's going to shout at me, and that's like being in a Downfall parody, it's terrible. So he hesitates and he checks back, and I think it's become very inhibitive. Now, it may be that suddenly something clicks and all these processes are internalised. I think you saw that happen with Bayern Munich, the famous game when they beat Roma 4-1 in November, I think it was, early November of this first season. And after that, suddenly they start playing great football because the players adapt and accept that. And they're not constantly thinking, what's the instruction? The instructions are internalised. And that clearly hasn't happened yet. And we're talking 50 games and they haven't internalised that. Now, maybe that's to do with transfer policy and the turnover of players. They haven't had time. But then you look at the transfer policy and you think, what on earth is going on with the forwards? How have they not... Rooney appears to be the first choice centre-forward, okay, Martial, but he's 19. Unproven. He's only scored, I think, 12 goals in his life. I mean...
it's more than Bebe.
Only Joss.
Yeah.
Is he Bebe in disguise?
And you think, for what Van Gaal demands of a number 10, his ideal number 10 was Jari Litmanen. When he was at Ajax, somebody who incredibly hard working, very good at winning the ball back. Now, he really is the best English forward in 20 years at winning the ball back, and yet he's not been used to do that. He's been used as the front man. So that all seems just really weird. But even if you accept Rooney could go back to being the centre forward he was in 09-10, wasn't he?
Yeah,
the other 30
so,
goals.
Yeah.
Which I don't think he can, because I think he's lost that explosiveness. Even if you accept he can do that, what if he gets injured? There's nothing there. So I think that what's happened in the last 48 hours with the United's transfer policy has been just bizarre.
David, what do you think? Do you think Van Gaal's cracking up?
What you expecting me to follow that with references to tactics and people from obviously the mid 90s? But what it's making me, a couple of things.
like Pedro, the reports were that he was going to go to United, and then he phoned his mates at United and they said, don't come here, because mm-hmm. Van Gaal's
a lunatic.
I'm a lunatic, and it's miserable and it's awful, and you don't want to be here, which isn't very clever. I do wonder sometimes if people have their time, not just football managers, just generally, like Greg Dyke for me is an example, where maybe in his day, before he didn't make the big money, maybe he was dynamic and, you know, he could actually grasp a tiny bit of detail before he made his mind up about an issue. But now, he's living on his reputation, and he just says things. I personally think he's been absolutely awful for the FA. And I've come across it a lot where, you get sort of senior people, if I can put it that way, and you're wondering how they're still in that position. And I remember somebody saying to me, you learn your lessons wherever you can get them, and this was about the chairman of Chesterfield, who'd sold Chesterfield to Darren Brown, who was presented as a young entrepreneur who was going to take Chesterfield up, you know, through the divisions, or at least up from the fourth division. And he turned out to be, he'd almost never had a job. He'd been in the Sun newspaper once for shooting his teacher. And it turned out that he'd gone into the club and nicked the money to pay this chairman for the club. And he ended up going to prison for 4 years, and that's what precipitated Chesterfield's crisis. And that was one of the first crisis clubs I ever wrote about. And I remember saying to someone, about that chairman, you know, like, why is everyone in this town sort of in fear of this guy? And he said to me, in his time, he was really sharp, really smart, really dynamic. Well, just wondering
this
if
was something we were saying on the train the way up. Yeah. We were saying that people like Ferguson, people like Lobanovsky are very, very rare. The managers seem to have sort of decade-long cycles in which they can be effective.
Is Mourinho next?
But do you think Wenger's one of them, where he's had his time?
Wenger,
that's a very interesting... What about Mourinho then, Andy? I mean, Chelsea are not having the best of times either.
No, they're not, and you can't jump the gun just because they've had a poor start, but... On the other hand, the thing that would worry me the most is the fact that he was tactically outwitted by Laurent Blanc in the PSG game last season. Laurent Blanc is, you know, let's make no bones about it, the guy's a tactical dunce. He's just got an incredible set of players.
Yeah.
But all they had to do, really, is dig in against a team that had a player more than them. And, you know, they absolutely deserved to win that tie. I think the real question is not what Mourinho does in the Premier League this season, but what he does in the Champions League. Mm. You know, he's stalled a number of times in the latter stages. Who knows, maybe Barcelona just drove him mad. That great Pep Guardiola Barcelona side simply drove him over the edge. But I do wonder, really, whether he has got the answers anymore. I think he's probably got one more big job in him, big club job in him, before he goes to Portugal, because he will do that before he packs in. But, you know, we both wonder where that could be. Maybe even Atletico Madrid, because there's...
That'd be great, wouldn't it?
It would, and there's absolutely no obligation to play good football there as well, which is really important as well, if you're looking at it from the Mourinho perspective.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's signed this contract with the idea that, you know, he's going to force himself into longevity.
Mm.
But it's all falling to bits already, really. Mm. But it's interesting, going back to Van Gaal, it's just his incredible capacity to fall out with people, and people that he's close with, like Robin Van Persie, like Victor Valdez. And I think when you talk about, you know, it's not just about him aging, it's about the game moving on as well.
Mm.
And when you look at Martial, and in many ways, he's a very, very typical Van Gaal signing, because, you know, the system is king, it's not the players. And, you know, he always says that he's really egalitarian, you know, whether a player, what did he say last season, whether he costs 50 million or 5,000, it doesn't matter to me. It does matter. If you cost a lot of money, you have to work a hell of a lot harder under Van Gaal to prove yourself. There's no doubt about that. But I think Martial, forget the price tag, he's a typical Van Gaal signing, because he's incredibly talented and he's young, so he can be moulded. But, you know, he's a modern footballer, so he's not like that. He's not like a normal 19-year-old. He's not a 19-year-old who's come out of the academy. He was the most expensive 17-year-old in French history. Now he's the most expensive player in French history. So will Van Gaal be able to mould him like he's been able, without any chat back, as he's been able to mould young players in the past? And I think it's doubtful.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned Ferguson in passing, and to me, what happened to Moyes and what's happening to Van Gaal, in one way, take all your points about Van Gaal himself in the detail and Moyes' limitations as well, but
it just offsets to me what a managerial talent, what a managerial genius Ferguson was. And I always think about, was it in his final season when they played Real Madrid at home and Nani got sent off?
And he didn't go in the press conference afterwards. Yeah. He was so distraught.
Nani got sent off and Mourinho made the quick substitution and Real Madrid beat them in that game. But before that, United were, I think it was 1-1, but United... Did United go 1-0?
I think
anyway,
they were 1-0 up.
United were attacking them. United were going at them. United were absolutely, you know, they were slaughtering them. And they had in the team Johnny Evans, cleverly. They had Danny Welbeck. They had 4, 5, 6.
Bebe.
They didn't actually have the new Ronaldo, but they had 4 or 5, if you include Giggs, if you include the senior players. They had some like 4 or 5 or 6 players that had come through United's youth team. And once Ferguson had gone, Tom Cleverley started to look like he couldn't play. Tom Cleverley was excelling in that game against Real Madrid. And didn't they? What did they win the league by in that last season? 12 points from City.
Like that, yeah.
And if you looked at that team, it was ordinary. Mm-hmm. And he won the Premier League over City with all the multi-million billion that they'd spent by then. By something like 12 points. And once he went, you could see that it was the sheer force of his personality. And he gave confidence to those players who were otherwise quite ordinary. And I do think it's saddening, because I've written this piece today about the transfer window, just trying to sum it up. And I was just looking at the list of players in and players out. And, OK, United, they've signed Martial, they've signed, they've signed quite a few random players, basically, that they could get. But if you look at the players out, Evans has gone this time, hasn't he?
Right.
Basically, the tradition that United had always prided themselves on and that Ferguson really prided himself on of having homegrown players in the team just seems to have been completely abandoned. Mm-hmm. And that's something that should have lasted long after Van Gaal's gone.
And we saw that when they sold Welbeck, of course, as well. Any questions from the floor? Yes, the man
there. Tyler Blackett, he's another one that's gone to Celtic on loan.
That's right, yeah. There's the hand, and here comes the microphone. Fire away.
Hiya. I was just wondering, has the change in the role of the fullback meant that teams can't defend anymore?
Has the change in the role of the fullback, does that mean that teams can't defend anymore? Is that the question?
I'm thinking like Patrick Van Aanholt, specifically.
Yeah.
Probably DeAndre Yedlin.
Yeah. Jonathan?
I mean, partly, yes. If you look at the role of a fullback... I mean, I think it was Jack Charlton after the 94 World Cup said that the fullback was the most tactically important position on the pitch. And his rationale for that was if you most teams in the 94 World Cup played 4-4-2. So if you imagine two 4-4-2s up against each other, the two centre backs mark with two centre forwards, the four midfielders cancel, and the players have space are the fullbacks. So they're the ones who can set the tempo of the game. So naturally they start to advance. And as the 90s go on, you see fullbacks becoming more and more attacking. I mean, I'm not saying they weren't attacking fullbacks before that, but I think it becomes more and more part of their, sort of a natural part of their role is to attack. And that has carried on even as 4-4-2 yielded to 4-2-3-1 and 4-3-3. It's now expected that the fullbacks provide the width. And even if you have wingers in the side, the fullback can help the winger by overlapping. So, Dani Alves and Messi being maybe the classic case, or Ronaldo and Contrao to, again, use something we were talking about on the train on the way up. Fullbacks have become very attacking. You look at heat maps of the best sides now, and you would have two defenders, and then the two fullbacks will be in a line with the one or two holding midfielders. So they've become very attacking, but I also think the art of being a centre-back is being lost. And I think the price that Mangala or Otamendi demands, I think shows that I've seen a fair bit of Otamendi playing for Argentina, and he's big, he's solid, he's decent, he's a good player, but I don't actually think he's particularly different to the sort of player that most top five clubs in England had two or three of 25 years ago. He's maybe a little bit better on the ball, maybe he reads the game slightly better, but he's not massively different. And I think a lot of his Otamendi's qualities are the sort of qualities we used to take for granted in the centre-back. And now, as sort of the Bielsa model, if you like, has taken hold, the Van Gaal model, that you have to play the ball out from the back. I mean, Van Gaal always talked at Ajax about how his number four, who was Frank Rijkaard on that side, had to be the playmaker. That the football had changed so that players out of the pitch had to do more defending, players at the back had to do more creating.
that ability to build a play from the back, to what Mascherano does for Barcelona, that becomes an essential part of a centre-back's role at a top club. And the downside of that is that the defending is forgotten about. I think partly also rule changes mean that if you defend as old defenders defended, you get sent off. So that makes it harder. So yeah, partly the role of the fullbacks, partly the role of the centre-backs changed.
Andy?
Yeah, I think the thing with Otamendi, for example, is, you know, people are so desperate to anoint the next great centre-half. I've seen a lot of him over his club career, apart from when he was at Atletico Mineiro. He was the best defender in La Liga last season. He was absolutely brilliant. But before that, you know, I wouldn't have trusted him to bring a tray of sandwiches back from there without spilling it. He was so accident-prone when he was at Porto. So I think going back to the fullbacks, though, it's interesting to see one of the bigger moves in the last week, seeing Levin Kozawa going from Monaco to PSG for €24 million. And you may have seen a bit of him when Monaco played against Arsenal last season. Terrific coming forward. But he trained as a striker, so that's normal. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you are left-footed, no matter where you play on the pitch, you will get stuck at left-back at some point. And, you know, he's the ultimate manifestation of that. He's a really, really good attacker. Defensively, he's borderline embarrassing. I think you kind of expect that to a degree when someone's 22. Like, you think how long it took Ashley Cole, again, another who was converted from a winger into a fullback, how long it took him to learn how to defend thoroughly and properly. And this was a guy who became arguably the best left back on the planet at some point. But I think that the fact that 4-4-2 has sort of evolved to be usable again, I think, is something that has really brought the fullbacks into players, attacking players. And bizarrely, I think that Guardiola's spell at Barcelona kind of informed that to a certain extent. Even though they didn't play 4-4-2, I think it made people work out how they could play 4-4-2 with a diamond, because the sort of sitter they had in Busquets dropped back to become the third centre-back because he had to, because the fullbacks, yeah, whether it was Maxwell and Alves, so ultimately loads more teams than are advertising it on the tin are actually playing with a back three, and fullbacks are expected to be attacking players. So maybe the fact that Kozawa can't defend doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter for PSG, because they're battering people every week in the French league. Whether they can get away with that a bit further into the Champions League, I think, is an interesting thing to watch.
Any more questions from the floor? Yeah, man in the front row. Smashing socks, by the way, sir.
What's been your most difficult interview?
The most difficult interview, Jonathan?
There's obviously two ways in which an interview can be difficult. There's ones you expect to be difficult because they're with difficult people or on difficult topics. But the worst one, let me think, it must have been just before year 2004. and England were at a training camp in, I think, Sardinia. And several journalists got invited over there. We were divided into pairs, and we were given two players each to interview. And the idea was we pool the quotes afterwards. So the big selection issue at the time, hard as it may seem to credit now, was Darius Vassell, and he had a hamstring issue. And was he going to be fit? And we watched him train in the morning, and Darius Vassell trained apart from the rest of the squad. So, yeah, everybody's sort of making their bids for what players they want. And because I was very junior, I'm pretty low down that list. So all the sort of glamorous players are gone. But I thought, Darius Vassell, at least there's a news line there. There's something kind of specifically going on. So I got Darius Vassell and Phil Neville. Now, Phil Neville's great, because, you know, Phil Neville will just talk, and he, you know, he's an intelligent bloke, and you know you're going to get good copy out of him. Turns out that's not the case with Darius Vassell. So the interview went something like, so Darius, how's the hamstring? Fine. Right, but you were training apart, so it's a problem. Yeah, it's a problem. But it's fine, yeah. Does it hurt? A bit. If it was a game tomorrow, would you be able to play? Don't know.
And he got 3,000 words out of it.
And I genuinely don't think he was deliberately being unhelpful. I think he... I'm told that with Darius Vassell, the thing he will open up about and will talk about is, certainly then, I don't know if he still is, he was a born-again Christian and was very fluent in talking about that. About his hamstring, not so much.
David.
Well, I think I'm just going to have to use this as an excuse to talk about Dave Whelan, really, because I can't think offhand of a really, really difficult one. And
he's quite loose with his tongue.
And it actually wasn't difficult at all, you see. So, and I was actually really tired, and I didn't even know what was really going on with Malky Mackay, because basically I'd been reporting on something else a day before, and I'd been really involved with it, and I didn't even really know that Wigan had hired Malky Mackay until I was listening to Five Live on the way back. And Dave Whelan had said that he'd said something that suggested to me that he'd been told by the FA that they weren't going to do Malky Mackay for, you know, because, you know... obviously, you know, all he'd done, you know, it was only like the worst racism that we've heard from any football figure over the past 25 years. And so it was literally like, just heard it on the radio and thought, oh, I'll follow that up tomorrow. That sounds outrageous, you know, if the FA is tipping off Dave. So it was really like an FA story that I thought, if the FA is tipping off Dave Whelan that they're not going to do Malky Mackay, that's bloody outrageous. I'm going to phone Dave Whelan in the morning and find out if this is true. So I phoned Dave Whelan in the morning and... he was setting his, and I said, "Have you been tipped off, Dave?" You know, it sort of seemed to suggest that you've been tipped off by the. And he said, "Absolutely, you know, I mean, and the lad's not done a lot wrong." So I said, "All right," and I honestly didn't know what was coming. So I said, "All right, you mean because it was private? Because we're private texts?" Ah, they were private, but you know, I mean, and at that point, right? at that point, right? The Daily Mail had broken the Malky Mackay story and had the texts, right? But they had the text between Malky Mackay and Ian Moody, the head of recruitment at Cardiff at the time, sorry. And but they hadn't said whose were whose. They were just email exchanges. So Dave Whelan said, well, that lad's not done a lot wrong. I mean, you know, he's called that lad at Cardiff a chink, you know. And when he said that lad... he was actually referring to Vincent Tan, who's about a 60-year-old billionaire maniac from Malaysia who owned the club. He's called that lad a chink. And I said, oh, right. So it starts to dawn on me that when Dave Whelan said he hasn't done a lot wrong, he didn't mean that they were bad messages that were private. He meant that the messages themselves weren't bad. And that's when he said to me... anyone who says they haven't called a Chinese person a chink is lying. So I said, right. I mean, you know, it's like being called a limey, which obviously, you know, English people just get called limeys all the time. Don't they? That happens a lot. I mean, and we've just had to tolerate that. Anyway, so then, I mean, good, you know, he must have got a thick skin being called a limey all his life and putting up with it like that. Anyway, so then, Dave Whelan's actually telling me which of the texts were Malky's. So I think I must have said to him, I think I must have said to him which were the other ones of, and he said, well, you know, that thing he said about that agent, about, you know, the Jew, you know, that. I mean, who hasn't said that? Which to me actually was like proper virulent anti-Semitism, what Malky Mackay had said about, you know, he said about the agent Phil Smith, nothing like a Jew that sees money slip through his fingers. Like, it doesn't actually get much worse than that. So I just had to sort of, you know, I just had to put to Dave that, you know, might that not be? I said something like, you know, don't you think some people might, you know, find that just a little bit offensive? And that's when he said the, you know, the classic, don't you? And his voice dropped, and he said, don't you think that Jewish people? What was it? That Jewish people chase money, just that little bit more than we do. And that's how the conversation happened. And basically, I put the phone down after all, and then he said everything else that he said. And I put the phone down and I thought, no one knows that I've had this conversation with Dave Whelan. I wasn't told to follow it up, I just decided to follow it up. I've just got, you know, but basically you've got a responsibility, you know, to report that. And I would, you know, I'm always writing about the FA must be stronger, you know, it's great that kick it out are tough on it, it's amazing the strides that we've made at fighting racism in football over the years. And if I've got this situation, which, you know, it's not going to be the easiest, you know, I know that it's going to end up being, you know, I'm not saying a difficult story, a difficult situation, but there's only me and him.
but I decided that, you know, that I had a responsibility to report it. So basically, it was 12 o'clock. I phoned into The Guardian. I said, right, you're not going to believe what Dave Whelan's just said to me. There was a guy working for The Guardian who used to work for The Sun. He was very good journalist. He's gone to Telegraph now, but he's got very much like, all right, mate. Well, that's it, mate. Yeah, get that one in, mate. Oh, that's going to be a big story, mate. And it was just like definite sort of thing. And so I wrote it. I rang the Chinese Centre in Manchester and said, what do you think about being called a chink? And she said, oh, that's terrible. I can't believe anyone's using that language. That reminds me of being beaten up by a skinhead in the 1970s. Because I wasn't exactly... fat Jew that sees money slipping through his fingers, I did actually know. I knew my way around that. I knew that was offensive, but I wasn't exactly sure. And she told me, yeah, that's deeply offensive. Anyway, so by the time I'd rung round and written the piece and sent it in, it was 3 p.m., right? So I spoke to him about 12, wrote it by 3, and by 6, and this is like the power of the media now, we put it up on the website at 6 p.m., and by something like 6:30, he just spoke to me. He didn't even remember speaking to me, and that's what he told the FA. He didn't remember speaking to me, and by about 6:30, 7 o'clock that night, he had cameras camped right around his house, and he was in the middle of an international incident.
There we are. Well done, David.
Thank you.
We can all agree on that. Excellent stuff. Andy.
I'm going to go for cultural misunderstanding as well, rather than being dead batted, because we've all been there through the combinations of media training and low intelligence. Although I agree with David, I think most footballers are really friendly if you're friendly to them. Mm. My most difficult interview was one that I actually couldn't use. I interviewed on my first gig doing filmed interviews after Champions League matches. I had Porto versus Fenerbahce, and I did Colin Kazim Richards.
Oh yeah,
Or Kazim, if he's known to the rest of the world. So when I stopped him in the mix zone, which is the bit where the players walk through to chat with you, or not chat with you if they don't want to, before they exit the stadium onto the bus, but just after they've left the dressing room, you just shout out. And so I went, Colin, a word. And he turned round, and I don't think he spoke much Turkish at the time.
It was familiar, a familiar accent he heard.
Yeah, exactly. So he stopped. And what ensued was what I thought was 10 minutes of film gold, but I realised might have been slightly indecipherable to non-London people when my Portuguese cameraman said, Andy, I never knew you spoke Turkish. And it was all unusable, because it was a brilliant chat, but unfortunately he libelled everyone he'd ever met in that 10 minutes, called Luis Aragonés a bloody old fool for only playing with one up front, and said that the Porto number 8 was safe.
Was that the Argentinian player?
Lucho Gonzalez, yeah.
Yeah. Did he not say, like, he was fucking wicked or something? And you were like, I can't use that.
No, but I was actually, like, vibing off it.
He went there. You were giving it the old Croydon lingo
but
as well.
He went there. Come on, London postcode. He went, a number 8 was safe, mate. And I was just going, scene. Couldn't help it.
Fantastic. We've got time for one more question. Does anybody have it? That man right there was first, I'm afraid. Sorry, chap. Here comes the mic.
So Pep Guardiola completed football this weekend by not playing any defenders. Why is that sort of experiment of bringing a former player through sort of reserves and then first team never really caught on?
Sorry,
So Pep Guardiola, brilliant manager, I'm sure we can all agree. Brilliant job at Barcelona, but he was obviously given his break at Barcelona. Why is that?
Oh, sorry, in terms of a manager, why is
that never caught on in England or really anywhere else?
Well, I mean, Ryan Giggs obviously had a little couple
of games. I mean, I think there's an issue with...
Sorry, do you mean bringing a player through and then becoming the manager of that club?
Yeah. Grooming a player, a former player as a manager at the club, which perhaps Man United could be doing with Ryan Giggs.
Yeah.
So players being groomed as managers.
I think English
managers.
Clubs particularly, there's a real conservatism. There's a real sort of fear of giving a job to somebody young. And the fact that Swansea took a gamble on Gary Monk and it's working so well at the moment, I think is again great credit to the way they're run and the fact that their way of playing outweighs personalities. But certainly... clubs who are seriously considering Champions League qualification, they all want a proven manager. They're never going to gamble on anybody young, anybody who's done well, even in the lower leagues. So I think Guardiola is a very special case. I think Barcelona's a very special case. Barcelona's had that way of playing, a quite a unique way of playing that began in the 70s, was reinforced with Cruyff in the early 90s. Guardiola was clearly very much of that school, that he grew up in a way that many of the players he'd have been working with grew up. The fact that Cruyff, who obviously liked him as a player and who made him his captain, although he didn't have a position at Barcelona, it was in the Diego Torres book on Mourinho that Mourinho was told, no, Cruyff will have the final say, even though he didn't have a position at the club. I think to expect another Guardiola is that's just an unusual situation. But I think there is a general issue with top English clubs. They just bring in whatever the flavour of the month is abroad, somebody who's won a Bundesliga or got to a quarter final of a Champions League. And I think, unfortunately, what happened with David Moyes is only going to reinforce that. There's a distrust of British managers who've perhaps succeeded with English clubs lower down the chain. And I think that's reinforced by the gulf that exists between the Championship and the Premier League. So a good young British manager will get his break at a Championship club. So, for instance, Alex Neil, for instance, at Norwich, started the season fine. It could happen with Eddie Howe at Bournemouth as well. Both started the season fine, but as the season goes on, as pressure starts to tell on squads that are on the deepest and they get in a relegation battle, it gets in people's heads. Oh, he's a coach of relegation battle. I'm not sure he's necessarily a particularly great coach, but Billy Davis's career as a top-flight coach was destroyed by what happened at Derby. And actually, getting Derby promoted was an astonishing achievement. What happened with Eddie Boothroyd at Watford, that I remember talking to Eddie Boothroyd and saying, does it bother you? You're known as a long ball coach. He said, well, look at these players. What else should I be? And he's right. Getting up with that Watford side was an astonishing achievement. The fact that he nearly kept them up was also quite an astonishing achievement.
But I think this is kind of linked to youth development as well, isn't it, in the case of Guardiola? And that's something that we're not fully invested in yet because, the idea with Guardiola is he was a son of the soil who would bring through the players. And I think it's no coincidence, if you look across at Lyon, for example, who are the other great youth academy in Europe at the moment. If you think 8 of their typical starting 11 last season were club products. I mean, that's part ideology and development, and that's part having an exceptional generation as well. But I think to have someone who is familiar with the academy, who's been a scholar, who can get inside the heads of those players is really important. So Lyon had Remy Gard to lead the current lot through. Now they've got Hubert Fournier, who is another one, who came through that academy. So even though it was an external appointment, he understood completely what was expected. And, I think, firstly, we don't have that sort of sense of widespread youth development, because if we're short of a player, and you say, like you were saying earlier, it goes all the way down the Premier League now, you just go out and buy them. But I think also it's about time, isn't it? I think there's no doubt about that.
Yeah. When Barcelona were making the decision between Guardiola and Mourinho, if you read Ferran Soriano's book, which is a deeply tedious book, so don't. But the one good bit of it is he lists the 9 criteria that Barcelona judged the candidates on. And one of those criteria was a willingness to bring through academy products. So I think of the 9, Guardiola ticked 8 boxes and Mourinho ticked 6. And that was obviously one where Guardiola got a tick and Mourinho didn't.
I think it's not that surprising that players don't make the step up to be managers very often, and that it very, very rarely works. And Guardiola's an exception in a lot of ways. But what I think is, what I've observed, not just in football, but in other walks of life, is that sometimes a braver appointment can be from within, rather than getting, like you say, the usual suspects from somewhere who are putting themselves as a prime candidate. People who are in that culture and can step up to become the manager. And I'm very surprised that more clubs don't try and do that. Like you're saying that United might be trying to do with gigs, but I'm not sure how systematic that is. Now, if you look at Liverpool, when I was growing up, probably older than some people here, but that was when Bill Shankly decided to retire. it was, and it is done well in the David Peace Red or Dead book that we were talking about before. People
we're
like
talking about offstage. You haven't forgotten that.
Sorry, that we were talking about before. People like Brian Clough, Don Revy. In the book, I don't know how true it is. He has Bill Shankly saying, "Who have you been interviewing?" Brian Clough, Don Revy, you know, the prime candidates, and they went for Bob Paisley, who was a very quiet. He was a genuinely quiet man. Had been the trainer and the coach all those years, carrying the bags of balls. And I was once on, talking to Ronnie Whelan. I had a great chat with Ronnie Whelan. It was really interesting and funny. And he, and you know, you looked at Bob Paisley, and he was a man of so few words, and he was so basically. You know, seemed so inarticulate, like just you know, like old guy in a cardigan and slippers, basically. And you know, you think, what is his magic? What was it? He was more successful than Shankly. And Ronnie Whelan didn't really give me, like a lot of Clough's players don't, he didn't really tell me what the magic was. And he said that when Bob Paisley was doing a was giving a team talk, Ronnie Whelan, when he was new to the first team, got told by one of the other Liverpool players, "Come on, you've got to see this." And he said that basically, when Bob Paisley was giving a team talk, all the Liverpool players had their heads down like that. You could just see their shoulders going up like that because everyone was giggling. Everyone had the giggles. But this guy was the most... Is he still the most successful British manager ever? I think he won three of the European Cups, I think. Mm-hmm. And then that was the brilliant appointment, the number two, wasn't it? Rather than going for the prime, the big names. Mm. And then they tried to do it again with Joe Fagan, and he wasn't quite up to it. And then I think that the stop...
I mean, he won a European Cup.
Yeah, but he was only the manager for a year or so.
Yeah, but that's because of Heysel.
Chaps, I'm afraid that our time is rapidly coming to an end. So we've got time just for one more question, which I'm going to ask myself. If you could go back in time and change a moment or event or a result from footballing history, what would it be? Less than a minute each. Jonathan.
Okay, year 2004, the press always had a sweepstake, and you put 10 euros in the pot, and you had to predict the score, the first score, in the minute of the first goal. Now, it was a double rollover, because England in the group stage, nobody predicted the 3-0 winning against Switzerland, nobody predicted the 4-2 against Croatia, so they're playing Portugal in the quarter-final, and I'd gone Portugal to win 2-1, Owen to score first, 8 minutes. It's 1,400 euros in the pot. So that moment when Frank Lampard made me A, rewrite a perfectly good match report with what turned out to be a pointless equaliser and cost me 1,400 euros, that moment. And what made it worse was the deadline was so tight for the penalty shootout that I had it written. And I just had a slot in the names of who'd taken the penalty that missed, the penalty that scored. And I looked up, I saw Nani Valente walking forward. I kind of Nani Valente, look up, ball's in the back of the net, file it. And it turns out Nani Valente had walked 10 yards forward, had turned back, and Ricardo, the goalkeeper, which is actually quite a key part of the story, had gone up and taken the penalty, and that did not feature in my match report until 20 minutes later when I phoned through in a panic. Yeah. As a question that the press conference made me realise I got horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah, I have to say you've changed your tune dramatically on that question which we asked before, because you mentioned if a Dutch player had scored...
Rob Rensenbrink.
Yeah, in the 1978 final, right at the end against Argentina. Cut long story short, it would have pretty much halted the military junta in Argentina.
And if you want more on that, you can buy my forthcoming book on this Argentine football, which will be out in March.
There we are. David.
Yeah, well, I've always been, since I started working as a journalist and writing about football, rather than enjoying watching it, playing it, absolutely obsessed with the fact that, as Jonathan mentioned in passing earlier, our Football Association, who are the governing body of football, for completely, heroically misguided and myopic reasons, supported the First Division clubs in their breakaway from the Football League, which meant that when the big money came into football, whether it was going to be from ITV or Sky, instead of it being shared through football, they've had the money in the Premier League. And most of the things that I really don't like about English football, like the fact that the clubs have been sold as investments to owners who've just been interested in football, have flown from the Premier League breakaway. So if there's one moment that I could change out of a great many choices, it's a lovely question, but if I was ruler of time and football for the day, I would stop the FA making that heroically misguided decision and keep English football together.
Yeah. More honourable than your suggestion.
Not just make 1,400 euros.
I think what I could have done with it.
Yeah. Andy.
I'm going to go World Cup as well, not Rob Rensenbrink, but perhaps an obvious goal that people will remember. I would scrub Diego Maradona's handball goal from the quarterfinal goal
and
in 1986.
You can read my forthcoming book.
I look like a plant now, don't I? But not because England would go through. I'm still not convinced they would have won the game. But I just think it sullies Maradona's reputation as a footballer, mm-hmm. not as a bloke, and colours the way
he's
that
done that himself,
think of
hasn't
him.
He? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What would you change out of his reputation?
to just absurd level, really, in this country particularly. And I just remember Barry Davis's grudging. Oh, we have to say that was magnificent. Well, bloody right, you have to say the second goal was magnificent. It's one of the best goals ever scored in the World Cup finals. Mm. I just think it's such a shame that people associate him with that rather than all the brilliant stuff that he did for Argentina and Napoli, because he is my favourite player ever.
I associate him with shooting journalists with an air rifle, personally. But, you know, that's just me. We've come to the end of our time. Thank you very much indeed for coming out. Thank you very much for your questions. Thank you, of course, to the Football Museum, the Manchester Football Writing Festival. It's been an absolute pleasure. The new Blizzard is out on general sale next week, so do snap that up. You'd be ridiculous not to, quite frankly. Thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure. Good night and God bless.